There's Feely one that hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Susan Shand, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Norway's National Museum says a sentence written on Edvard Munch's 1893 painting, The Scream, was put there by the Norwegian painter himself. The famous painting shows a figure holding its head in its hands with its mouth wide open. The artwork has become an internationally recognized symbol for the expression of human fear and concern. The sentence written on the painting says, "Can only have been painted by a madman." It was written with a pencil in the top left-hand area of the painting. The painting is being prepared to be shown at the new National Museum of Norway, which will open in Oslo, the Norwegian capital, in 2022. The painting has been the subject of a lot of careful research. In a recent statement, Maybrit Guleng, head of the National Museum, said, "The writing is, without a doubt, Munch's own." Guleng added, "The writing was compared to the painter's writing in letters. The handwriting itself, as well as events that happened in 1895, when Munch showed the painting in Norway for the first time, all point in the same direction," Guleng explained. "The writing was added after Munch had completed the painting. But for years it has been a mystery," the museum said in a statement. Guleng said the writing was likely done in 1895, when Munch exhibited the painting for the first time. At the time of its first showing, the painting caused many people to wonder about Munch's mental state. During a discussion night when the artist was present, a young medical student questioned Munch's mental health. "It is likely that Munch added the inscription in 1895, or shortly after, in response to the judgment on his work," the statement read. Munch was hurt by the accusations. He wrote about them many times in his letters. Both Munch's father and sister suffered from mental issues. Munch was put into a hospital after a nervous breakdown in 1908. The National Gallery was temporarily closed in 2019 to secure a safe moving process to the new National Museum. The museum will show 400,000 objects from ancient times to the present day. I'm John Russell.
Animal activists in Cyprus are asking officials to expand a hunting ban throughout a group of salt lakes near the coast. They are worried that migrating flamingos could possibly eat deadly amounts of lead shotgun pellets. A flamingo is a large bird, usually bright pink or orange, that often walks along the waterline in coastal areas. Martin Helikar is director of BirdLife Cyprus. He said flamingos are at risk of eating the small pellets that lie on the edge of the water as they feed. Last year, we had tens of losses of flamingos, Helikar said. Cyprus is an important stop on the migration path for many kinds of birds flying from Africa to Europe. The Larnaca Salt Lake is a wetlands area of four lakes. As many as 15,000 flamingos from colder climates arrive on the southern coast of the island nation in the eastern Mediterranean. They stay through the winter and leave in March. Hunting is banned around most of the Larnaca Salt Lake, but hunters are still permitted to shoot ducks in the area's southern end. The government's Game and Fauna Service says in the first 2 months of 2020, 96 flamingos were found dead in the Larnaca Salt Lake wetlands as a result of lead poisoning. Panayotis Constantinou is an official with Cyprus Veterinary Services. He has examined the dead birds and confirmed that they were poisoned by lead. The amount of lead pellets increased 2 years ago after a heavy rain caused many to come up from the ground around the lake. A sport shooting range near the lake's northern end closed nearly 18 years ago. Officials then organized a cleanup of lead pellets in the area. But Helikar says the cleanup was not effective. The European Union paid for an investigation to identify where large amounts of lead pellets remain, so they can be removed. Early results show very high lead levels in the wetland's southern tip. Continued duck hunting there could make the problem worse, Helikar said. The danger is real for the flamingos and other birds that use the area, he said. Cyprus Hunting Federation official Alexandros Loizides disagrees. He says that hunting in a 200-meter area is not a problem due to the small number of hunters. He said chemicals used by nearby farms are creating a pollution problem that hurts the birds. I'm Susan Shand.
Human activity is changing the surface and temperature of the planet. But new research shows it is also changing the sound of the Earth's oceans and seas. Scientists say the changes in the sounds of our oceans, seas, and other waterways affect many marine animals, from very small shrimp to huge whales. Sound travels very far underwater, Francis Juanez told the Associated Press. Juanez is an ecologist at the University of Victoria in Canada. He is also co-writer of the recent research published in the magazine Science. For fish, he explained, sound is probably a better way to sense their environment than light. Sounds help fish and other marine animals survive. They use sounds to communicate with each other. Sounds also help some ocean animals find food and avoid their hunters. Many ocean animals use sounds to find good places to mate. However, increased noise from humans is making it harder for these animals to hear each other. The noise is coming from shipping traffic, motorized fishing ships, underwater oil and gas exploration, offshore construction, and other noisy human activity. For many marine species, their attempts to communicate are being masked by sounds that humans have introduced, said Carlo Duarte. The marine ecologist at the Red Sea Research Center in Saudi Arabia co-wrote the paper with Juanes. Experts at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, explain the term masking on its website. Masking happens when one or more noises in the water block sound important to a marine animal's existence. The Red Sea, Duarte said, is one of the world's most important shipping passages. It is full of large ships traveling to Asia, Europe, and Africa. Some fish and other animals, he said, now avoid the noisiest areas. Also, the overall number of marine animals has gone down by about half since 1970. In some parts of the ocean, scientists now record fewer animals singing and calling than in the past. Those voices are gone, said Duarte. Juanes and Duarte examined studies and research articles documenting changes in noise volume and frequency in the world's oceans. Then they put together a detailed picture of how the ocean soundscape is changing and how marine life is affected. Scientists use underwater devices to record fish sounds. These sounds are in the same low frequencies as shipping traffic noise. NOAA experts state that masking is most noticeable when a noise is at the same frequency and loudness as biologically important sounds, such as mating calls. Climate change, the researchers found, also affect physical processes that shape ocean sounds. These include such things as wind, waves, and melting ice. Experts at NOAA say that effects of noise on marine mammals are not well understood. However, some studies suggest that noise may cause hearing loss. The stress from human noise might also affect the immune system, an animal's natural defense system, as well as reproductive health or behavior. Imagine having to raise your kids in a place that's noisy all the time, said Joe Roman. He is a marine ecologist at the University of Vermont and was not involved in the research. Roman added that it should come as no surprise that many marine animals are showing higher levels of stress due to noise. Another marine ecologist not involved with the paper is Neil Hammerschlag of the University of Miami. When people think of threats facing the ocean, he said, we often think of climate change, plastics, and overfishing. But noise pollution is another essential thing we need to be monitoring. If you make something for the ocean, Hammerschlag suggested, think about how to make it quieter. Scientist Juanes says sound pollution may be easier to deal with than other ocean threats. In theory, he said, you can reduce or turn off sound immediately. It's not like plastics or climate change, which are much harder to undo. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue our series of time capsule programs, each one exploring another facet, decade, or period of America in the 20th century. Science brings an end to World War II and lays the groundwork for a new attention to research, development, and scientific education in the years to come. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team, and in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. Scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets, and they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.